Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
You lie.
No, I am.
You lie.
I think there's still room for civility in this podcast.
Liar.
You know what you're channeling?
Yeah.
You're channeling some of the elements, just a tiny percent, perhaps, of the town hall spirit from August, and bringing it into the chamber of the United States Congress, or perhaps even, yay, into this.
But it's working. Look at Barack Obama's approval numbers, down to 51%.
Wait a minute. How long have they been going down to 51%? Haven't they been going down to 51% for quite a while?
I'm not sure if much has changed since the outburst we saw at the town hall meetings this summer. But
actually, where the slippage appears to have happened was more in July than in August. His numbers came down more in July and then stabilized somewhere around in August, as there was probably a certain amount of backlash in response to some of that negative energy in the town halls, which, of course, took a lot of the momentum out of the health care debate. So the president tried to restore some of that momentum this week when he gave his speech to a joint session of Congress.
The time for bickering is over. The time for games has passed. Now is the season for action. Now is when we must bring the best ideas of both parties together and show the American people that we can still do what we were sent here to do. Now is the time to deliver on health care.
I think that what we heard there is the essence of the president's message. Some rhetorical flourish, some argument, some evidence, but essentially it was a pep rally for the Democratic side of the chamber.
And not only a pep rally for the Democrats, an opportunity for Democrats to unite, because the Democrats are not talking to themselves either. In the past week, we saw Nancy Pelosi saying there's no way a bill gets passed without a public option. Max Baucus says there's no way a public option passes the Senate.
They're both right. Nancy Pelosi's not going to get a bill out of the House without public option in it. And Max Baucus is right in saying public option's not going to survive in the Senate. There aren't enough votes for it. There are too many Democrats who have too many reservations.
But there is one bill that's going to come out.
That is correct. And in the conference between the House and the Senate that will follow on the passage of whatever bills we do get out of them, if we do, that's where the decision will really have to be made. And it won't be a public option like the House wants. It'll be something else like a trigger or a fallback or some other language that allows the Democrats to say, oh, well, we got enough, and vote for it. If they get that, then they can pass the conference report without a filibuster and probably with just a majority of votes in both chambers.
Obviously, the goal for President Obama was to reclaim the conversation. In other words, take back the leadership of the conversation, which he seemed to have ceded. Now, I do remember, and Ron, I know you remember too, September 1993, Bill Clinton gave his speech on health care to a joint session of Congress. And when it was over, we thought, boy, he did the job. He knocked it out of the park, even though it was the wrong speech in the teleprompter. You remember that story. But ultimately, we were wrong.
We were wrong in part because we assumed that Congress would, in some sense or another, get its arms around what the Clintons were proposing, both Bill and Hillary.
They were doing more than proposing. They were
insisting.
My way or the highway.
That's
right.
And ultimately, that turned out to be the wrong strategy, at least for 1993-94. Bill Clinton's popularity, for reasons that were not necessarily related to health care, was descending rapidly. He had a lot of other problems. The country was not necessarily with him on health care, and they certainly weren't on board for the specific plan that he and Hillary insisted on.
He was a minority president. He got, you know, less than a majority of the vote.
43% of the vote.
And the Democrats were in Congress for 40 years, and so there was a tiring of that as well.
That's right. They were a weak majority. Right. They didn't know just how much of a hollowed-out majority they were. This is a different situation. President Obama is a majority president. He has a little bit more momentum. The health care situation has deteriorated further in the ensuing 15 years, and much of the health care industry, other than the insurance industry, has changed its mind about many of these issues and is much more supportive of some sort of new system. Now, that doesn't mean that this Congress is going to succeed either. It just means that it's a different situation, and we are at a different point in the legislative calendar, and there is more momentum in the odd-numbered year. Clinton never really had a good shot at getting it done in 93. He had to depend on it getting done in 94. An election year turned out to be a highly contentious one. So the deck was really stacked against the Clintons, a lot worse than it seems to be stacked at this point against the Democrats and Barack Obama on health care.
Well, we know that there were several intended audiences for President Obama's speech. Obviously, it was the American public, because some polls show that they're not convinced that the Obama plan, whatever that plan is the right way to go. And, of course, we talked about the warring Democrats, but then there's also Republicans, too. You know that President Obama would not want a bill without any Republican support, not because he can't get 60 votes. He may very well get 60 votes if there's a new senator appointed in Massachusetts or whatever. But obviously there is a reach out, part of a reach out to Republicans. He mentioned John McCain by name. He mentioned Grassley and Hatch when he was talking about Senator Kennedy.
And he may have actually been thinking about Olympia Snowe throughout that whole time, so she's probably a better chance than any of those three.
And yet, shortly after the speech, Olympia Snowe came out with a release saying, I will not support anything with a public option.
Right. So you have all kinds of pushback from the Republicans. The president chose at a moment when he could have said, okay, look, the partisan approach isn't working. We really do want to do this in a bipartisan fashion. If you look at all the great changes that Congress has passed, there has been at least a measure of bipartisanship about them. Civil rights, Medicare, and so on. Sure, there was opposition from some parts of Congress, but there was some measure of at least nominal bipartisanship. And the president wants at least that much for this big change as well. I feel like he made the decision that he is, at this point, just trying to marshal the forces. It sounded like part of his campaign from 2008. He's marshaling the forces that elected him president and trying to get health care done on that energy.
I mean, we've seen many states of the union and joint sessions of Congress meetings in the past where the president's party will be up and applauding. And I mean, I think Biden and Pelosi must have lost 20 pounds jumping up and with all that excess, you know, applauding. The opposition, in this case, the Republicans, sitting on their hands. And of course, it was also the spectacle of Republicans waving, yes, we do have our own plan, and they would wave their plan on health care as
and,
well.
And one had a little sign that said, what bull?
But there was also the spectacle of that South Carolina Republican Joe Wilson, that was not expected.
That's right. He had heard enough when the president started saying that some of the criticisms of the health proposals were lies, specifically the allegations that we're going to pull the plug on grandma because something in the bill said there would be end-of-life counseling, that sort of thing. And when the president used that term lie, you could feel the tension rising in the room. You could hear Republicans starting to grumble audibly, talk amongst themselves. There was a building sense of tension. And then there was this moment.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally. Not true.
I heard the interruption and I heard the booing and I didn't know what was said until later. And just the thought of a member of Congress, no matter what party, talking to a president, no matter what party, calling him a liar from the floor of the Congress is just something you don't see every day.
We have heard heckling from the floor of the House before.
They booed George Bush.
There was a moment when Dick Armey was a majority leader in the mid-1990s when he was talking back to Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton was giving a State of the Union address. Now, it wasn't as punctuating as this moment was.
And Harry Reid, I think on Meet the Press, said, I think it was about Yucca Mountain or whatever it was, and called President Bush a liar. But it's different when the president is addressing the nation and Congress to yell it out from the floor of the chamber.
Well, it's something that we're not used to. We're not used to seeing
the British
parliamentary.
Yeah.
That's right, a parliamentary debate. Now, the Brits will call their prime minister any name in the book. They'll call him things that aren't in the dictionary. But what they wouldn't do is speak that way to the Queen or the King. And we have no head of state other than the president. So for some people, the president is the United States. He's the commander in chief. And you just don't talk to him that way. That undermines the civility, if you will, that is part of our civic religion.
And yet, a lot of that civility went out the window this summer with the town hall meetings. We saw it with Arlen Specter. We saw it with Clara McCaskill. We saw it with Ben Cardin. We saw it with a lot of members of Congress. My question is, does the Joe Wilson outburst on the floor of the House, is there an advantage for Barack Obama in this, all this?
You know, I think potentially there is, and that's probably the reason that the Republican leadership immediately said after this incident that they wanted Joe Wilson to call the White House and apologize.
And he did.
And he did. And then he came out the next morning and had a kind of shaky brief news conference in which he sort of sounded a little like he had wished he hadn't done it. Also, we had John McCain and other people kind of calling him out on it. I think they were all thinking, number one, they don't like that display because they are conventional, if you will, conservative Americans, and they don't like to see that violation of the usual civility pact. The other thing I don't think they liked about it was what you're suggesting, that there could be some benefit for Obama in having, if you will, the uglier moments of the town halls. And I'm certainly not painting the entire town hall phenomenon with this brush, but there were ugly moments and there were a lot of ridiculous things said. That spirit seemed to be brought right into the chamber of the House by Joe Wilson's calling out. That, I think, is something the Republicans are not comfortable with.
And according to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, in the hours since Joe Wilson's outburst, his Democratic opponent, who held Wilson to 54% last year,
Rob Miller,
who's an Iraq War veteran, has raised $200,000 in the hours since then.
I suspect Joe Wilson will raise some money around this, too, there'll be a rally around Joe Wilson effect. But Joe Wilson's district, while it's got the highest median income in South Carolina and certainly voted for John McCain and George Bush, it also gave 45% of its vote to Obama last November and gave Rob Miller a little better than that, which was the first close race that Joe Wilson had in winning five terms in Congress.
But I also watched the morning after the speech. I was looking at Joe Wilson's Twitter page, and every second there would be more follower. He gained like 400, 500 in a matter of a half hour. So there are people out there who, I don't know what that means. I don't know if it means anything about a reelection. It could be from Utah for all we know. But there are a lot of people who just seem to say, look, he told it like it is, or at least that's what you saw on Twitter.
I think you're also getting a certain number of people signing up because they want to see what other kinds of things Joe Wilson will say that might be used in this way we're describing. I just think it's volatile to use this kind of tactic when you are trying to rally your portion of the country, which is obviously substantial, against the president at a moment such as this. If the president can get his forces mobilized in the way that his opponents have been mobilized over the summer, then health care, I think, has more than a flicker of a chance of getting to be law. The president actually gave two controversial addresses this week. Before he talked about health care, he went to a school in Arlington, Virginia, and told the students, now get this, that they ought to stay in school, work hard, and wash their hands.
I did hear that, and I believe everything that President Obama said. I agree with everything he said, and I will vote for Democrats for the rest of my life.
Ah, so it's working. It's working. We are turning America's youth into robots.
We are.
And they are all going to do exactly what Big Brother wants them to do.
And you know who it mostly affects? It affects kids who have braces who are in magnet schools.
I understand many of them are drawn to those schools.
Yes, they are.
The only question that's left to ask about that speech is whether or not it was, in fact, altered from the original plan. I think originally the president may have asked the students to do something to, quote, help the president accomplish his goals. That was in the language, at least that the Department of Education was circulating.
I do have the original speech.
Ah, good. He says, let's go with that.
I want all the kids to follow your own destiny. But listen to your teachers, work hard, and join me in the fight for socialism. And I thought that was really a moving thing. I don't know why they kept that out.
I'm surprised they didn't do it on May Day.
But seriously, one of the most moving things, I think, of the Obama speech was, I think, the way he concluded and said this is basically what Ted Kennedy fought for his whole life. It was part of his legacy. It was part of his dream.
Real sucker punch for a couple of the Republican
friends. It was
friends
easy.
Of
and of course, by mentioning
called them all out.
Hatch and McCain and Grassley, right?
Yeah. I was wondering how he was going to go to that well, and he left it right for the very end, and he set up so that you were actually slightly surprised to hear the name Teddy Kennedy. And then, of course, the cameras all go to the Kennedy children in
Vicky
the
Kennedy,
gallery,
the widow,
who was fighting back tears, sitting next to the First Lady. Well, the theatrics of it were nonpareil. I mean, that it really recalled for me the perfect theatrics of the Reagan period, where Nancy Reagan would be sitting with just the right person in the gallery and lay her hand upon the arm at just the right moment, and the president would get a tear in his eye, and one would just have to say, wow.
One Kennedy, by the way, who is not in the House gallery, was a former member of that body, Joseph Kennedy, Joe Kennedy II, who announced, I guess, last week that he will not seek Ted Kennedy's Senate seat, and many Democrats, members of Congress, former members of Congress, were waiting to see if a Kennedy would run. Vicky Kennedy,
that's right.
Unlikely. Joe Kennedy announced this week he will not run.
So with no Kennedy, it's Oklahoma land rush. All the Democrats who have ever been in Congress, all the Democrats in the state legislature in Massachusetts will all be running.
Some have already announced. The Attorney General, Martha Coakley, has already announced her candidacy.
She's kind of my candidate at this point because I think all the House members might cancel themselves out.
They could, and she's the only one who's run statewide. And, of course, she's only the only woman, and Massachusetts has never elected a woman to the Senate. And also other members of Congress, Stephen Lynch, who's from South Boston, kind of a blue blue-collar kind of guy. He took out his nominating papers last week as well. We're still waiting for Ed Markey. And while no Republican, as Ron, you pointed out two podcasts ago, that no Republican has taken a Massachusetts Senate seat from the Democrats since 1946.
But one pretty strong candidate might be considering getting in this time, and that's former White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card.
Andrew Card, of course. Now, Andy Card ran for governor in 1982 when nobody ever heard of him and finished poorly. And I suspect he doesn't run, but the name, his name has been thrown out there. Of course, we heard Curt Schilling's name that was out there, and that's not going to happen either.
Pitcher for the Boston Red Sox.
Ultimately, look, there are two things that are going on right now. One of them is that this week they had a hearing at the Massachusetts State House to try to change the law to allow Governor Deval Patrick to name a successor, an interim successor. But more importantly, all eyes are on December 8th, and that's when there'll be the Democratic primary. And I suspect whoever wins that primary will win the January 19th general election.
That's right. And the reason that you would have somebody in the interim, of course, would be to provide that 60th vote should the Democrats need it on health care. And, of course, anyone that Deval Patrick were to appoint would probably have to be somebody who only served as a placeholder and was there for just these months until January 19th.
Michael Dukakis' name has come up a bit, which is
as someone who could be a placeholder, that's another possibility. And also, of course, the widow might also take that role, even if she doesn't want to occupy the seat permanently.
And, of course, the departure of Ted Kennedy leaves a major committee without a leader in,
yeah,
in
briefly.
The Senate.
Didn't take them too long to decide who was going to take over there. The chairman of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee is now going to be Tom Harkin from Iowa.
I thought he was Agriculture Committee chairman.
He has been, and that was, we all assumed, his natural chairmanship, that he'd want to stay in for the rest of his life. But he's also been very interested in health and in education and in labor policy all through his career. And now what he's going to be able to do is he's going to be able to be chairman of that authorizing committee for all those areas and also, at the same time, chairman of the Subcommittee of Appropriations. Are we getting wonky yet? The Subcommittee on Appropriations that funds all those same policy areas. That's an extraordinary kind of power.
I also suspect that we have not seen the end of the controversy over health care legislation. And Chris Dodd, the banking committee chairman who could have taken over Ted Kennedy's committee chairmanship, I think the fact that he's in such a close contest for re-election next year, the last thing he wanted was more controversy and to be the poster boy for why health care failed or didn't accomplish what it should have accomplished.
And he also thinks maybe he can run against Wall Street. It's going to be a little bit of a feat considering how close he has been to Wall Street and how closely
and
tied
he has
been.
And the pharmaceutical industry.
But right now he seems to think that as the Senate banking chairman, he's got a better political position for his very tough 2010 re-election campaign.
And replacing Tom Harkin at agriculture will be Blanche Lincoln,
who is in a tough battle.
And there are a lot of farmers in Arkansas who, against the committee chairmanship, could help her bid for another term.
Absolutely golden opportunity for Blanche Lambert Lincoln.
And here's some more good news.
That's the end of this week's political podcast.
Not soon enough. You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
Liar. And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR News.